the Buddha, through the Dharma, through the Sangha. Burmeister has kept saying that she didn't understand the fifth column. Well, now she gets the fifth column. And the reason why she didn't understand it is simple. You can't understand it. You can't understand it. To understand it is to try to understand the eternal. Because the fifth column is really the eternal. You can't understand it. So if you can't understand it, what can you do? You know, it is. That's enough. It is. Something in us knows that. Something in us knows it even when we don't think we know it. It is. And you can't understand it. So it's not surprising. It was incomprehensible. And Room Master's had experience of it and has always known it. She says, it's just before breakfast of the same day. I think that same day is the 9th of November, I think, but it doesn't really matter. In my heart, there are two golden doors standing wide open, and inside them is a golden lotus. I am conscious that the lotus on my head has changed from pink and indigo to gold. The five columns of light come out from it and mark the Buddha, and the mark of the Buddha is in the center of it, and then again in the center of my forehead. Light is coming out of the fire, out of the flower. I remember reading this. Sometimes I feel like I was just getting overwhelmed with symbols, kind of drowning in the symbols, and now, what the heck is this? What the heck is this? Here's another one. What the heck is this? Let me just say a few words about the symbols and about where they are, because this matters. You know, everything in this means something. There's nothing that doesn't mean something. That doesn't mean we have to get all the meaning. No one gets all the meaning. But it's important to trust that everything means something. It's in here because it means something. Look at the points where these things are. It's as if Zahara has doors that are open, and in it is the lotus. You know, Zahara is incredibly important, and it is as I've said many times. And the Zahara is where we experience things that we can't explain, and yet we experience them. Things like that mixing and melding I talked about. It's where the karma gets cooked, as it were. It's also the shadowy hall of stillness. It has many aspects. Remember how the last chapter ended with the spine and the body being experienced as the physical nyoi. Here, there's more teaching embodied here in, you know, the spiritual nature of the body, the hara, the place where we experience meditation as centering. There's a lotus there. There's a lotus on the crown of the head. From the crown of the head is where, ideally, I remember Master saying something about when you die, you're supposed to kind of like what's called the spirit body, you're supposed to go out the crown of the head. And indeed, people experience, and Kensho experience an opening, the crown of the head opening. And it's from the crown of the head that the full recognition of the eternal happens. Again, not understanding, recognition. Buddha recognizing Buddha. Then there's a little Buddha in the, let's see. Yeah, there's the mark of the Buddha in the lotus on the head, and there's the mark of the Buddha on the forehead, at the heavenly heart or the third eye. And these are important points. They're called, you know, in the yogic tradition, they're called chakras. You know, but we don't use that term. But they're important points where things or experiences happening at important points in our spiritual life. Dogen said, you know, this body is deeply significant. And Reverend Master is experiencing here the deep spiritual significance of the body. It's, you know, it's why what we do with our bodies really matters. People who misuse the body, break the precepts with the body, you know, it really matters. Because, again, as I said yesterday, this is the inherent true nature of the body. The true nature of the body is that it is of the eternal. And here is some of the ofness of the eternalness of it being displayed in an exquisite way. She says, speaking of the doors of the hara, the kind of doorway, that, and you know, many of us have experienced this, maybe not with you know, experience it as, you know, the kind of vision form as doors, but it's experiencing it in meditation, experiencing the hara opening wide. The kind of, we speak of an open heart, but it's really that it's a whole being openness is what happens when we really open. In meditation, we let down the defensive guard of the self and just open. And then the gates of the temple doors, as it were, and the body is like the temple of the eternal, the gates of the temple stand open wide. Here's what she says. This is the meaning of the doors of the temple always standing open wide. The doors of the heart never being close to anyone who asks for help. And that's one aspect of the meaning. And remember, another aspect of the meaning is that if this body is truly of the eternal, then the eternal will use it to help us and our karma as well as other beings. So it also means that the doors of the eternal's compassion and wisdom, the doors of infinite love, are never closed to me. And my own meditation is proof of it. And the doors of the compassion, wisdom, and love are never closed to any aspect of my karmic inheritance, any aspect of my suffering, any aspect of the causes of my suffering. It's really important not to see an egocentric eye here. There's no Koshin to whom Koshin's body belongs. There's no Koshin to whom Koshin's mind belongs. What we call Koshin is body and mind. Every aspect of which is of the eternal and is revealed as such. When Koshin has a good sense to live and train in a perceptual way. And it's obscured when Koshin doesn't. And yet, whether it's revealed or obscured, the eternal is. And every aspect of our body and mind are of the eternal. This is true in life, it is truth in dying, it is truth in death, it is truth in birth, it is truth in rebirth. is true in rebirth. It is. Everything is of it. The first four columns show positions, as it were, in the process of conversion. This is beyond conversion. This is, whether conversion happens or not, this is. That's why this chapter is called the Iron Being, the Iron Man, the Iron Being. She says, everyone has entrance to the Kaido, the shadowy hall within themselves. All they have to do is knock. See, because, again, it doesn't belong to me, it belongs to the Eternal. So when I sit down on that cushion, sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and ancestors, open my heart, allow the mind to quiet, allow myself to become centered, there is the shadowy hall then manifests. Why does it manifest then and not when I'm running around like a chicken with his head cut off, all cut up in worries and the like? Well, it's not because it didn't exist when I was worried and running around like a chicken with his head cut off. It always exists. It's just, am I in a position, putting myself in a position where I can know that it exists and can experience it, that it exists. The practical implications of this are wonderful. It means no matter what has happened in the past, no matter what kind of load we're carrying of confusion and pain, that the same treasure house exists for each of us as exists for the Buddha and for River Master. That all we have to do is do the spiritual training. She says, all they have to do is knock, all they have to do is ask, and they will be answered. That's the understatement of the year. You know, it's one of the great gifts of the retreat that I did in 98-99 that I truly at last learned to ask. That doesn't mean I don't still forget to ask at times. I do. But I really learned to ask there. No one can go through that kind of experience and not learn to ask. Because if you didn't, you would die in despair. You have to learn to ask, and you do. And that changes everything. That changes everything. If your first step is false, you'll immediately stumble. How many times do we experience we forget to ask, and everything seems to not go quite right? We remember to ask, and even if it doesn't seem to go quite right, we have this deep sense that it's still right. Reverend Master, in the early days, she didn't talk so much about asking. Before 76, she didn't talk so much about asking, if at all. I remember her talking about, what was the phrase I just thought of, and just slipped my mind. Oh, letting go of self, or getting self out of the way. And of course, that's what asking does. A true, sincere asking gets self out of the way. But it's actually, I have found it so much more helpful to know that it's the asking. And this comes from really coming to know more and more deeply that there is that help and there is the need. And that the need can always look towards the help. In whatever position you find yourself, you can always look towards the help. What the fifth column is saying is, no matter what you may think or anyone else may think, and no matter what you may feel or anyone else may feel, The help is always there. That is just the way it is. It is. The eternal is. This one comes to know in one's blood and bones. It is. Whether I'm well or sick, brightly alive or dying, hold fast to the Lord of the house. That underlies all the columns. It underlies every position in the process of training, in the process of conversion. Because it is the reality, the Lord of the house, the eternal, the imperial mother. That's the some of the teachings refer to the imperial mother. It doesn't matter whether you view it as male, female, and it. It doesn't matter. It's beyond all opposites. She says, the light streams out of the flower, speaking of the flower in the Hara. It is the light with which I was infused last night, the infusing with gold. It comes out of the flower and colors my flesh until my entire body is golden. This color thing, by the way, I want to say that we're about this color thing, because it really does happen. There are times when, with, as it were, spiritual eyes, you see gold. And there's times when, the most interesting thing for me, because I've always kind of disliked pink. You know, like Barbie pink, you know, that kind of pink. I always disliked pink. But then, at a certain period in 99, later on in that long retreat, I started experiencing what is more poetically referred to as a rosy glow. And you start to like pink. The rosy glow. It's like there's the ordinary world your eyes see, and then there's this intuited rosy glow, as there is this intuited gold. And these colors have a meaning. Sometimes Rim Master would speak of a color of old gold rather than a really bright gold, a kind of deeper hued old gold. Sometimes one experiences that in the Hara, with or without a particular symbol. If you experience none of them, don't worry about it. If you experience none of the gold or the rosiness or any of that, well, you know the dark. And that's a kind of color too. And where there is the dark, there is a capacity for the colors, the other colors. Don't despise the dark. She says, then comes Makka Kashyo. Makka Kashyo, of course, is the, in Zen, is always viewed as the greatest disciple of the Buddha and the first patriarch in the transmission. Then comes Makka Kashyo. This time I am with, you know, Makka Kashyo, the great disciple. So, what is it River Master is a disciple of the eternal here. A disciple of the eternal being led by a disciple of the Buddha. Ultimately, what is our discipleship to? It is to the eternal. That's the true meaning of discipleship. She says, then comes Makakasho. This time I am with him as a golden being, and the two of us travel up and to the right. Suddenly we start going straight up. I am infused with golden spiritual water again, the water of the Spirit flowing freely and fully. We are absorbed right into the fifth golden column of light, and there is neither of us left. Just two beings that are and were and will be part of, and not apart from, the golden column going upwards and upwards. There is nothing else. Experiencing the difference, our seeming difference, dissolving into the oneness of the eternal. I ask what to do and am told to go on. I choose to come back, told to go on, not ordered to go on. I choose to come back in order to be able to bring this back to you. I ask, am I wrong to return? And am told, your choice, it does not matter. Have I made a choice between dying and living? No. So she doesn't try to explain what exactly the nature of that choice was, but she knows that she came back to bring it, to bring this teaching back to us. And personally, I'm glad she did. I don't know what might have happened. But I do know the eternal will never do harm. And I know that at least once in my training, I have, in the midst of this incredible flow of the water of the Spirit, teetered right on the edge of death. And I've known at the time, I knew very clearly, I knew that I was on teetering on the edge of death, and I knew that I didn't care in the least. And I knew that whether I lived or died, it would not harm me. And that in this particular case, I knew that I would not die. It was not time for me to die. The water of the Spirit can just, when the timing's right, can just take you with it. And it's important one does not willfully ever try to make that happen. It's not about suicide. The Buddha talked about this with his disciples, and this is something he must have just regretted the rest of his life, and a bunch of them went out and killed themselves. You think the Buddha didn't ever make any mistakes, but of course he's not the one who killed himself, they did. But he must have made it sound so good, you know. But don't jump the gun on death. When Dogen says in the Rules for Meditation, the ability to die while sitting and standing, which transcends both peasant and sage, is obtained through the power of meditation. I've always thought he means that literally. That ain't just some symbolic thing about dying to self, which is, you know, of course dying to self is good too. If you don't care, try to carry that too far and try to kill the self. But I've never thought that that was a symbolic thing. He said, I myself have seen, and I think in China, when he went to China, I think he saw some old monk or old monks actually just sit up in meditation and check out when the timing was right. Apparently that's what happened with Sek Kim Singh, or Master's Ordination Master. The way I heard it, he sat up and when the time is right, died. But is this a willful act, or is this a response to the call from the Eternal? I would want to think it's a response to the call from the Eternal, and that's how I would want to die, as it's how I want to live. I don't want to live in impulsively ignoring the Eternal. Why would I want to die that way? And I know this is true of River Master. River Master said, others in this room may have heard her say it at some point or other in her last year, you know, say, I'm so tired. You know that, you know, she was ready to go. But she did not try to make it happen willfully. And as a matter of fact, when all conditions ripen, when it was ready to go, she just quietly slipped away. Just quietly slipped away, really, when no one was looking. She quietly slipped away, and there was just Reb Nasser Echo with her at the time. So she put up with the fatigue and the difficulty, and it was very, she was very, very fatigued and very difficult for her in her last months, her last few years really, but especially in her last year. And she waited till the time, till the call from the Eternal came, and then just went with. At this point, you know, it's not the time for her to die. I mean, we needed her for another 20 years, you know. We needed her. I'm not sure how much she needed us, but we needed her. I know I needed her. I'm very, very glad that she stayed with us. She says, "Now the golden light that comes out of the clouds and the fifth column of light turn into the iron pillar that I saw in the dark place, the Iron Man." She used this term. She learned it in Sojiji. She learned the term the Iron Man, the Iron Being. And she used this term long before 76. Used it a lot. You know, that place when you sit really still and you just let go of everything, the place of the nothing matters. The place of just holding fast to the eternal. The just sitting. Just taking refuge in the stillness and letting go into it. Just letting go. The place where there is no complaint. If you want the kind of practical daily readout. The place where there's no complaint. She says, "This pillar penetrates the universe from one end to the other. It pierces me through my forehead, entering the earth at the base of my spine. Every aspect of body and mind, this pillar right through the body, as it were, every aspect of body and mind included within it, or parts of it." She says, "I can go back up this pillar at any time I wish or come down in the same way." In other words, just by doing pure zazen, just by pure meditation, you go up that pillar. "It is that which makes heaven and earth one. I am bathing again in the golden light. There is ecstasy in the infusing of my body." Remember that the heaven position is the help position. The earth position is the need position. How can they ever get at each other and do the mixing and melding so that the transformation can happen of the need unless there is a fundamental unity of the two? This is where it's so easy for non-mystical religion to get it wrong, to create a separation between man and God that is unbridgeable. And there is no unbridgeable separation. For you, for me, for Rev. Master, for the Buddha, for Hitler, there is no unbridgeable separation. Because however out there the need gets, it is still never actually separate from the eternal. It's just that the eternal is not going to do our work for us. The eternal is not going to do our part for us. So if we choose to leave the need just hanging out there in ignorance of the, in seeming ignorance of its help, and in seeming separation from its help, the eternal is not going to do it for us. After all, why does it matter to that which is the unity of both, the help and the need? Time means nothing to it if we don't bring the two together. Well, someone else will one day. If it doesn't happen in the life of this universe as we know it, it will happen in the life of another universe. If it doesn't happen in this realm of existence, it will happen in another realm of existence. Because all the need gets met That's really the meaning of that law of the universe, where Matthew used to mention now and then. Without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails. But it's really talking about conversion. Without fail, all the need's going to get its help. The question for me is whether I'm going to be the person who helps the eternal bring the two together. Whether I'm going to do my share in the work. It's only because she did her share in the work that Rim Master is able to experience these exquisite and profound experiences and come to know the teaching. She says, I took the Bodhisattva vow long ago. I keep it still. However, innumerable beings are, I vow to say them all. Thus I choose to come back. But even after the vow, to do so is still a voluntary act. The Lord does not insist upon the keeping of the vow. This is one way of understanding this vow. But remember, there's a more primary, fundamental way to understand the Bodhisattva vow. And that is in terms of that the innumerable beings that are being saved are the innumerable, seemingly, they're not actually infinite number in any one being, but they seem like it at times, the many aspects of the spiritual need that each of us has inherited from the past. So the Bodhisattva vow in that sense is to keep hanging in there with the training so that all of that need can find its way to the help. All that need can be brought to the altar of the heart so that the love of the eternal can get at it. And all of it can be enlightened. This is what prevents the Bodhisattva vows from being a resolve to be a do-gooder. Because it's not, at its root, the vow is not about something outside ourselves. It's a vow to take full responsibility for our own karmic inheritance and to be willing, and it's a willingness here, not willfulness, to be willing to help with any additional load of need that the Eternal may ask us to help with. That's different from kind of launching out to be a savior. I think, you know, I don't need to dwell on that point. Her master's not saying she's anyone's savior here. Zen master is no one's savior. Zen master can't do it for us. She says, this iron pillar, which is the entrance to heaven and hell, is the direct route by which we go in the twinkling of an eye to the Lord during the first penetration of heaven Kensho. When we learn to harmonize heaven and earth, help and need, we are permitted to go slowly, that the way may be plain for us to show to all living things. He who would fulfill the Bodhisattva vow must reach this stage. It's one thing to make the vow, it's another thing to fulfill it. You know, vows are actually made to be fulfilled, not just to be repeated as a vow over and over again. And our master is saying, to fulfill the vow, we have to get to the stage of the, what's called the third Kensho, the harmonization of all of the karmic need with the eternal. Otherwise, the vow goes unfulfilled. How is it that the iron pillar, which is the entrance to heaven and hell, is the direct route by which we go in the twinkling of an eye to the Lord during the first penetration of heaven Kensho. It's because that Kensho is a leap beyond the opposites, a leap of pure faith and surrender beyond all opposites. And where are you when you leap beyond all the opposites? I've told the story that about 2 days before I popped my first Kensho on February 8th, 1977. I was with her master in her house for a short while when everyone else had left. The Reverend Master was actually in bed and I was meditating. I asked her, Master, I asked her, how do you jump, how does one jump off this cliff? How do I jump off this cliff? And her Master didn't say a word, and the answer actually came out of my own heart, just as if it was being spoken in my ear. And I just kind of opened my mouth and it came out of my mouth. The answer to my own question came through me, as I really think it had to at that time. It was, you live in free fall. These things didn't have to make any sense to my head. But you have to live right, you have to let go and live in the letting go. I had to let go and live in the letting go. And 2 days later, the Eternal took me up on it. And it is. It happens at that point. It happens in the twinkling of an eye, just as she says. You get it. You get it. And the water of the Spirit, which is the love of the Eternal, flows unimpeded like a million volts of electricity through you. That is a beginning of training, not an end. And it's unfortunately true that there will be many people, there are many people who have a wonderful first Kensho and never fulfill the promise of it in this lifetime. That's why it said that for a person who's had a first Kensho, which in Indian Buddhism is called the stream entrant, they have at the most 7 more rebirths. Well, 7 rebirths can be a lot of misery. And as I understand that teaching, it's saying, you who've had a first Kensho, don't get swollen-headed. Lots of people do get swollen-headed. I got swollen-headed a bit, I'm afraid, after it. It's a natural thing to happen when you're kind of shot from hell to heaven, like, on a bullet, riding a bullet, as it were. But that teaching is saying, don't get swollen-headed. The first realization of the Eternal is not the same as the complete conversion of all the karmic need. It's not the same at all. Conversion takes time. Conversion takes the training that is done through time. It isn't an instantaneous matter. At a later point in these talks, if someone will remind me, I'll talk about the Kenshos in their kind of numerical order, the way Reverend Master taught us about them. The 1, 2, 3, 4 Kenshos. True, as our master says, we learn to harmonize heaven and earth. We go in the third Kensho, we go slowly, so that the way may be plain for us to show to all living things. And it is true that a person who's had this experience or is in the process of this experience can explain the steps in a way that they couldn't do before. And River Master certainly is showing that here and showed it later in even more detail. You know, she was teaching for another 20 years after this experience and always learning more. The later teachings she did about this process are amazing. And certainly at the time she gave them, just way beyond me, I have to say. But even though they're beyond me, I have always treasured them and always hoped that they would not always be beyond me. Maybe they won't always be. Should the Buddha, should the Dharma, should the Sangha.